The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. England go to Eastern Europe to carry on their painless journey to the Euros. A Ramsey-less Wales have to go to Slovakia, while Scotland's fading chances continue in Russia. International break seems like a convenient time for Football League managers to get the boot. Sunderland, Reading, Barnsley all on the lookout. Mark Hughes could be moaning at a referee near you soon. Speaking of moaning managers, Phil Neville goes nuclear in Portugal. We've got an update on the Guardian's Next Gen series and vital updates on the latest footballing legend to somehow end up in Guildford. There's Spanish internationals DJing at your local pub and Carabao draws in space in what has been quite a fun few days. We'll do all that, answer your questions, 100% of which were about one thing. Frankly, I thought better of you lot. Welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. For a few years now, someone who I trusted has been consistently informing the Guardian newspaper of my private posts and stories. Over the past 5 months, I've posted a series of incredibly boring stories to see if they made their way into the Guardian newspaper. And you know what? They did. The story about giving up my Champions League final tickets to be with my dad, the story about how I like League Two, and then the latest story about how I like playing football. It was Marcus Christensen. How do you plead?
Not guilty.
Are you getting a forensic lawyer in?
A lot of people have access to my email. It could have been literally anyone.
Okay, I understand. Philippe Auclair, nice to see you.
Very nice to see you, Max.
How are you?
I'm not too bad.
Yeah. Hey, Barry Glendinning.
Hello.
Did you enjoy yesterday on the Twitter?
I did, yeah. It's very entertaining on an otherwise slow day.
We were wondering how much football we had to talk about before we got onto that story that you lot are very interested in. We will begin, though, with England. Go to the Czech Republic tomorrow night, Bulgaria on the 14th of October. Before we discuss whether going to Prague on a Friday night is a good bit of planning, let's talk about the England squad, which you haven't really done in detail. Tammy Abraham, Fikayo Tomori, both in, both committed to England. Delph's out injured, Tom Heaton is out injured, and Dean Henderson from Sheffield United has come in. No Kyle Walker again. No Dele Alli, no Jesse Lingard. Wan-Bissaka left out. He was in the squad last time. Philippe, do you think they're all quite legitimate decisions from Gareth Southgate?
Yeah,
seems quite sensible to me.
I think I can add one line. I think that's breaking news. I think James Maddison has just retired from the England squad. I think we need to check.
Retired?
Well, retired for this particular fixture, for this particular series of fixtures. I think just that he had a little gah and decided to opt out. So that's one fewer.
Yeah, James Maddison withdraws from the qualifiers, which I suppose changes arguably the most interesting part of the England team, Barry, which is what's their best midfield. I was looking at Pickford picks himself, I believe. Well, I believe Gareth Southgate picks him, but you know, he should pick him probably.
I'm not sure he should.
Well, it's a bit shaky of late.
I don't think young Master Pickford is as good as he was, say, in the run-up to the World Cup. And I'm not so sure he should be automatic first pick. I think in these qualifiers, it doesn't matter a huge amount who plays, to be honest, because England are going to qualify at a canter. But no, I certainly don't think Jordan Pickford should rest on his laurels, because I don't think he's having a particularly good season. I don't think he had a particularly good season last season either.
However, the competition is not the strongest currently. Nick Pope, who is a very good player, and Dean Henderson looks good, and Tom Heaton is good, but it's not Clements and Shilton, is it?
No, it isn't. But like I say, I don't think it matters a huge amount in the qualifiers, but I was just countering your assessment that Pickford picks himself.
Okay, so am I correct in thinking Marcus, Alexander-Arnold, Chilwell pick themselves?
I would say so, yes. For now, and they are very strong. I think you saw at the Leicester-Liverpool game, I thought it was a cracking game, the fullbacks going at each other, and they were obviously two of them. And I think one of the interesting things to come out this week was obviously the thought of Alexander-Arnold playing in midfield, which may be a discussion for later. But I think it's really interesting in what
Bayern
has
done
with,
for Liverpool on a couple of occasions, if I'm not wrong.
I'm not sure I've seen him there, but it's a kind of Philipp Lahm, Kimmich kind of, and Pep likes his fullbacks to play in midfield, and he's clearly got the talent. Not for now, but could he get into that later, maybe. He's got the passing range. He's got the kind of intelligence, I would say. But for now, obviously, at fullback.
So then you got Harry Maguire and A.N. Other, who I can't work out who you'd go for. Joe Gomez.
Very little game time.
Yeah, it was dropped by Liverpool recently, wasn't it? Michael Keane, who, as we established last week, points in excitement when he sees other professional footballers on the pitch. And Tyrone Mings. And Tomori. I mean, I out of those... I mean, Tomori isn't experienced, but he might be the most interesting.
I agree with you. And I was very surprised because at the beginning of the year, we thought Tomori would be very much the... perhaps the last in the hierarchy of central defenders at Chelsea. But obviously, I think we hadn't looked at him closely enough when he was at Derby. And also the way he's adapted to that level is remarkable. It's obviously, it's not just that he's strong, athletic, very good footballer, but also it seems like in terms of personality, absolutely no problem. He took it to it very, very easily. So that would be an interesting one because, I mean, we have to face it, the Czech Republic is not quite... the Czechoslovakia of a few years ago, or even the Czech Republic with Rosický and players like that, it's very far from the being this, at the same level. So that might be an opportunity. So Tomori Maguire,
okay, and then who's your? Do we all think it will be Sancho, Kane, and Sterling? And in fact, from those three, is Harry Kane the
You're really struggling over saying that, aren't you? Well, saying that out loud,
is,
Max.
Is there a case for? I don't think there is, but I don't think you would drop Jonathan waving his arms. Get on with it. Say it out loud. Is there a case for playing Abraham or Wilson over Harry Kane?
I think there is a case for it. I think it would be a bit unfair to drop Kane. He's not playing particularly well at the moment, but he hasn't done much wrong in an England shirt. But why not give Tammy Abraham, who's in form, a chance?
I think it's more likely you're going to see Kane start and Tammy Abraham coming on at a later stage, which will probably be one of the youngest set of three forwards England has ever fielded in a qualifier. I'd love to see it, I must say.
Yeah. And then midfield, which I think is the most difficult. I mean, I think Southgate will pick Declan Rice and Jordan Henderson and one of, now Maddison's not there, Mount on Barkley. What would you do, Marcus?
Well, the way Southgate has set up for a long time now is obviously the 4-3-3 that is not dissimilar to the Liverpool one with three very solid midfielders, especially if Barkley is picked instead of Mount. And I wonder whether sometimes you go 4-2-3-1 and have Rice and Henderson, who I think should probably start, and then a three of Sancho, Sterling and Mount, then maybe if Maddison is out, and Kane up front, just to try something. They're going to qualify anyway, and we know what they can do with a solid midfield, so maybe try something different.
I was nodding, which of course on a pod is not very useful, is it? But I would agree with that, and I would much rather see Mason Mount than Ross Barkley, who is for me the greatest enigma of English football, who will soon overtake Michael Carrick in terms of number of caps for the country, which is quite an astonishing feat.
Are you saying an enigma when you mean fraud or not?
No, I wouldn't go with fraud. That's a little bit binary. He's not a fraud, obviously. He's a very talented player who has been very highly rated by a number of managers, so there must be a reason for that. But I just simply don't think that he's got the nous needed of an international player, that's all.
Tammy Abraham says England are prepared to walk off the pitch if they're targeted by racist abuse in the qualifiers this week. The game in Bulgaria on Monday is in a partially closed stadium because of fans' racist behaviour in June. Tammy Abraham says, if it happens to one of us, it happens to all of us. Harry Kane even said that if we're not happy, if a player is not happy, we all come off the pitch together. The protocol, UEFA's three-step procedure that Southgate has explained to the players. One, the referee stops the match, asks for an announcement demanding the immediate halt of such racist behaviour. Two, if the racism doesn't cease, the referee suspends the match for a reasonable period of time and requests the teams to go to the dressing room as a further announcement is made. And three, if the racist behaviour continues, the match will be abandoned. Are we all in agreement that that Abraham is right? I mean, I
it's entirely up to him and his fellow black players what they do if in such an event. I'd just be curious to know what the ramifications would be for England if they walked off the pitch. Would, you know, UEFA dock them points or fine them or
Well, I mean, if you
award
had a protocol,
the win to Bulgaria.
You're right. Even though there is a protocol here from UEFA, you wonder if they would stick to it if a team actually followed through. That would be the fear, right?
I sincerely hope that they would not follow the protocol and they would walk off the pitch, because it's just, this protocol is utterly ridiculous.
I mean, the protocol doesn't legislate for players walking off the pitch.
I think that it would be a very serious offence. And in terms of the statutes and regulations of the game, if you walk off the pitch, you basically forfeit the game. Hmm. You know, that's what normally should happen. But maybe something like this is needed for something to be finally done. Because, again, these three strikes and you're out is absolutely ludicrous. That's what they employ in the Belgian first division for people lighting flares. You know, don't do that, naughty boys. Oh, we're going to go off the pitch and, well, to calm down, which, by the way, happened in a game recently when they walked off the pitch in the fourth minute of added time when they were only 15 seconds to play. They walked off the pitch and stayed out of the pitch for 8 minutes. And then they came back. And then the third, if you carry on, we will abandon the game. That's ridiculous. And in a way, I think it's empowering the people who are behaving badly in the stands. Why not be clear? I mean, we're all agreed we shouldn't have it. UEFA is the first to say that's something which is simply not acceptable. So why have this gradual approach when these primes have been there for ages and in some particular grounds? Walk off. Absolutely.
And just to be clear, there's a difference between being taken off by the ref and walking off.
Yeah.
So I think if they did walk off, they would probably be punished. But I'd still, you know, be wholeheartedly behind them if that's what they decided to do.
And what about Prague on a Friday night?
Well, I would imagine that's going to be an absolute a car crash. It's going to be like the world's most awful stag do. You know, 6,000 largely male visitors in the city, cheap beer. We've seen how English fans behave in Amsterdam recently, in Porto, their antisocial behaviour, which I think a lot of them don't actually realise is antisocial. Mm. And this is poor behaviour, as opposed to hooliganism. This is just annexing the town square, littering, singing their repertoire of xenophobic songs, getting pissed up and just behaving atrociously. And then whinging when the police get involved, as the police should, because their behaviour is bang out of order.
Now for something slightly different, while we're on England, shall we? Owen says, is Jonathan Wilson's position as football's best detective under threat? One of many questions. Just to explain, if you don't know what we're talking about, Colleen Rooney, the wife of Wayne Rooney, had believed for quite a long time that somebody was selling private stories she was putting on her private Instagram stories. But I need to explain to Philippe what Instagram stories are.
Yeah, no idea.
was leaking them to the Sun. So she hid it from everybody's view except for one account, and then started putting these quite tremendous, you know, stories about gender selection in Mexico, and one about a basement flooding in her new house. They all made it to the Sun, and she said, I have saved and screenshotted all the original stories, which clearly show just one person has viewed it. It's Rebecca Vardy's account. Click. How long do you reckon, Marcus, she hovered over the over the send button?
I think it was prepared for more than a week, surely, and the excitement, if that's the right word, or whatever you call it in the office, when it landed and people just stopped. It was surreal, but it was such a perfect post, if there is such a thing.
Why do we care about, you know, this is the sports desk of the Guardian, right? We shouldn't, you know, we are going to get on some pretty serious stories in this podcast. Why do we care about this? I can't say I don't. I was utterly gripped.
Yeah, so was I. We should be better as human beings, but clearly we're not, and I think we're not alone in that. I had discussion about why we think it is, but it is. I think, like you said, it's gossip. It was so unexpected. It was just and then it spread, and the reaction, and so on. And sadly, it was you could either get the popcorn out or hide behind the sofa. It was both of those kind of scenarios, but everyone tuned in.
It's fun, and fun is fun.
Especially at this time of, you know, yes. Trump being Trump and all the Brexit stuff. And it's just frothy light relief of little or no consequence, but fascinating nonetheless. We should add, in the interest of balance, that Rebecca Vardy has, of course, denied that she is the person who's been ratting out Colleen to the press.
Well, she said, "I liked you a lot, Colleen. I'm so upset you've chosen to do this, especially when I'm heavily pregnant." I'm not sure how that defines things. "I'm disgusted that I'm even having to deny this. The Sun has not disputed Rooney's suggestion that Vardy was the source, but has amended all the disputed stories on its website to note that they could have been fabricated." Anyway, tremendous fun. Wales, currently fourth in Group E, with a game in hand over the sides above them. They go to Slovakia tonight, got Croatia on Sunday. Aaron Ramsey is out of the first game. This, Barry, is the cause of much sadness for our friend of the pod, Ellis James. He's not played for 11 months for Wales, Aaron Ramsey.
Yeah, and it could be argued that even ahead of Gareth Bale, he's their most important player. I listened to Ellis's podcast with Danny Gabaldon and Ian Roberts this week, and it was basically an hour-long lament about the three boys being absolutely distraught that Aaron Ramsey isn't, probably wouldn't be fit. It's his doctor. He pulled up, I think, in the warm-up for Juve's last game. And they're very concerned about what's going to happen. I mean, Wales, they're playing Slovakia away, Croatia at home. They need 4 points, minimum, from those two games. And I have a feeling they're not going to get them. The lads sort of arrived at the conclusion that Ryan Giggs needs to amend his usual tactics of trying to play expansive football and shut down Slovakia, play five across the back. Bale on his own up front, five cross back, two sitting in front of them, Bale on his own up front, and then there were
three sitting in front of them.
they weren't too sure about who to play in midfield. Ryan Giggs has said himself that, you know, he had this moral dilemma over whether or not to pick Tom Lawrence after the Derby County bonding session gone wrong, horribly wrong. And basically confessed that after consulting with the Football Association of Wales, with Derby County and with Tom Lawrence himself, he decided to pick him just for football reasons. Now, the problem with that is Tom Lawrence is due in court 2 days after the game against Croatia. So is it going to affect his ability to play? Is it going to be preying on his mind? There will be people who think he shouldn't be selected. Giggs has him in the squad anyway. And there's a very real danger that a very talented generation of Welsh players is being wasted because the blokes managing them aren't very good. And I think if Wales mess up this group, which I have a feeling they probably will, that Giggs will be got rid of. Because I don't think he's covered himself in anything even remotely approaching glory since taking the job. Wales played one really good game under him, and that was against the Republic of Ireland when they looked like Brazil, but that was against a shockingly bad Republic of Ireland team.
Goes against how the rest of the class of 92 have turned out to be excellent managers. It's a nice story about Wigan's Kiefer Moore, though. He was a 12-year-old ball boy on the books of Torquay United. He had to look elsewhere for football when Torquay closed its youth system down, played for sides in the South Devon League like Paignton Saints, Truro City and Dorchester Town he played for as well in the Conference South, where he was a lifeguard and a personal trainer in the week. Had a successful trial with Yeovil in 2013. Wales got in touch, and his grandfather is Welsh, and he said, "I told my agent there was a lot of back and forth because we couldn't find my grandfather's birth certificate. My mum was searching everywhere, scrambling around the attic, everywhere. The whole family were looking for it. We had to send a copy."
They should have sent for Colleen Rooney.
They should have done, shouldn't they? Anyway, so good for him, and good luck to him. Northern Ireland still second, level on points with Germany. It is potentially a slightly false position given the games they played earlier and the games they have. They're 3 points above the Netherlands, have played a game more. They go to the Netherlands today. Tricky.
It is very tricky. They've had double header coming up against the Netherlands, basically away today and then at home in the next round of international fixtures and then Germany away. So if they qualify through the traditional route, they'll have bloody earned it. It looks a tall order. But Michael O'Neill is confident, and there's every chance that they'll get an opportunity to go through the back door through the Nations League playoffs. And I think they'd probably deserve that because they're doing okay in an exceptionally tough group.
Yeah. You know. Germany in that group played Argentina yesterday, didn't they?
To be honest, I was watching it without watching it because thinking, well, actually, what's the point? I mean, so many players were absent. Germany looked really good, yep. Then took their foot off the gas, and then Argentina came back in for no particular reason, really. And you ended up with a German team. I think I would like to know how many of those players would actually feature in the starting 11 at the Euro. I don't think that will be half of it, probably not even a third. So
maybe not, although Kai Havertz played an absolute blinder again. He's 20. God knows how many Bundesliga games he's got already, 60, 70 yep. or something. The Leverkusen midfielder, outstanding. I thought he was great. And Serge Gnabry scored a wonderful goal.
Absolutely sublime.
His first touch took three or four Argentine defenders. They all came crashing in. He just flicked it over them and then scored with the outside.
It was so improbable that the commentator was saying it was a lucky thing. This was lucky. No, it wasn't lucky.
Yeah, it was
a stroke of a magnificent improvisation. And the finish was glorious as well.
It gave Richard Jolly a chance to open his almanac.
Uh-huh.
Serge Gnabry has scored more goals against Argentina than he scored for Tony Pulis. So. talking of Germany, Bastian Schweinsteiger has retired. Not a bad career he had.
No. I mean, a career that ended with a... which is a real pity when you think of the magnificent player he was early 2010s.
I must confess, I thought he'd already retired.
Oh no, he had gone to the States and to finish his career in the United States of America. And I think, you know, how would you remember him? I think we won't remember him for as good a player as he was, precisely because of the fact that his career nosedived, that he was not that convincing, to say the least, when he went to England.
Mm-hmm.
And when he was only, 31, something like that? So he was still relatively young, but it's a light that shone too briefly, but he was a magnificent player.
While we're on players retiring and on this group, Gareth McCauley announced his retirement from football after 23 years in the game last week. Former Leicester West Brom Rangers centre-half won 80 international caps for Northern Ireland, scoring 9 goals. Began in the Irish League with Crusaders. He said, I knew last season was going to be my 23rd and final year as a player. 23 years, a good stint, isn't it?
Yeah.
Bravo.
Very dependable player as well.
How many years are you into your Football Weekly career, Baz? 12?
13.
13?
13. Mm-hmm. Do you reckon you'll get another 10?
I don't know. Fresh blood coming in. Lou is on his way.
That's true.
Could Johnny Lou could...
can Lou and Glenn Denning
knock me off my perch?
It's more can Lou and Ronnie play in the same team. That's
well, I was having this very discussion with Sport Ed this morning.
Really?
You know, two number 10s.
Yeah.
How are you gonna fit them in? And he reckons he can do it, so I've every faith in him.
What a whimsical paper we'll have, eh?
I'm just enjoying everyone, the new blood coming in, various Guardian people being announced at promotions, and I'm still doing the exact same old shit as usual. Know your limits.
Well, maybe you just don't play the game enough, Barry.
I don't play the game at all.
Wear a suit. See what happens.
But no one wears a suit.
Have a shave, wear a suit.
I should go to more sort of drinks receptions and stuff. You told me I should do the same at TalkSport.
Yeah, absolutely.
Go to more be more sociable.
Be more sociable. You're very sociable just in one place, and there are very few media executives in that place, I presume. I don't dare go there. Anyway, good luck to Gareth McCauley and whatever you decide to do. And we'll cover the rest of the Euro previews in part two.
The way things are isn't the way they have to be.
But knowing what to challenge and how to change it isn't always clear.
That's why independent journalism has never mattered more. when we are free to follow any lead
and question any authority,
we can confront the status quo,
uncover vital alternatives,
and bring clarity to the world's most complex issues.
We can help our readers understand the world.
So together, we can fight for a better one. Hope is power.
And with your support,
you'll always find it
at The Guardian.
Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Some live shows for you. October the 30th, the Science Museum, Football Weekly versus Science, a sellout. The big one, November the 27th, Indigo at the O2. Last chance to see Football Weekly live in London for quite a while. Me, Barry, Jonathan Wilson, Ellis James. We got a big room to fill, so buy a ticket and bring everyone you've ever met. December the 20th, the Belgrave Music Hall in Leeds. That's me, Lars, Jonathan Wilson, and one more. Somebody tweeted me yesterday to go, "You're doing a live show on Mad Friday in Leeds. Good luck." So I didn't know that Friday was called Mad Friday, but there we go.
Every Friday or just that specific Friday?
I believe the Friday before Christmas. And I don't know if it's just in Leeds, but okay. Mad Friday we'll be doing. January the 27th, Liberty Hall in Dublin is almost a sellout. And only me and you have been announced on the bill, Barry. Do you think that's people just, you know, it's the homecoming for Glendenning. two more there. And if we sell out, we may do, last time we did a residency, 2 days. And, you know, a bit like Britney Spears in, is it Britney Spears in Vegas?
Yes, or Celine Dion.
Oh, yeah, one of those. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, you know, they play every night, sell out for 12 years. We'll do Monday and a Tuesday. Come along, please. Right, Scotland, fifth in Group I, 6 points from six games, no real chance. I think they've got to win everything. They go to Russia today, then they've got San Marino. What's the point?
I had a shock this morning when I opened the paper and I saw Scotland-Russia 61-0. And then for a second I thought, what? It's the rugby, yes.
Well, Robertson had a good game, didn't he? That really bombed down the left. They played Tierney and Robertson together and just overcame the Russian right back. What should Scotland... I mean, Scotland do have this second way in. You've said for quite a long time, Barry, that they were going to rest on their laurels and use that as their way to the Euros.
Yeah,
and that's all they can do now, really.
That appears to be what they've done. Scotland are odd because they have some undeniably good players, but they're short up front and they're short in the heart of defence, and that's killing them. Because with the players they have, they should be easily good. But they're fifth in their group. I mean, that's disgraceful. But I think that securing that playoff place was the worst thing they ever did, because I said it at the time, they're going to down twos, and it just mentally relaxed. And they went out and got hammered by Kazakhstan.
Yeah, but I mean, there's continual comparisons with the Republic and with Northern Ireland and their sort of relative achievements with their relative playing.
Scotland have a lot better players than the Republic of Ireland than Northern Ireland.
So then is it just a selection of badly picked managers, or is there something psychological or some sort of
self-fulfilling
prophecy?
Just an apathy about the players. I mean, but as I say, they don't score many goals. They're light up front. They've got, I think they're taking six wingers or strikers to Russia, and those six forward players have eight goals between them, international goals. You know, that's pretty poor. But then, you know, they've a wealth of talent in midfield. They've two brilliant full-backs, unfortunately both of them play the same side of the pitch. Kieran Tierney hasn't been selected for these squads because Arsenal are trying to manage his return to fitness. But, you know, it doesn't really matter how they get on against Russia, because their chances of getting out of the group, qualifying, I think they're 9 points behind Russia, who are in second place, so...
And they must have been...
But a good performance is obviously better than a bad performance.
Yeah, sure.
You know, I've seen papers are making so desperate for something to write about, you know, big up and drum up interest in this game, that Steve Clarke has banned flip-flops, you know.
Oh, really?
Players aren't allowed to wear sliders. I didn't know they were called sliders.
I didn't either.
To the dining room, you know. And it's basically Steve Clarke has introduced a few new rules about what you wear, people turning up, eating together, leaving the dining room at the same time, and just imposed his own little team rules. And this is one of them that the press have seized upon to sort of point and laugh at, oh, look at Scotland, they're not allowed to wear flip-flops.
Wearing flip-flops for dinner, you know? I mean, I've done it in warmer climes than Scotland, but I would frown upon that. I wouldn't care. I'm going to take it back.
I would kind of frown upon it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Make an effort.
I just don't think you should wear flip-flops with trousers.
You could be sitting beside Ollie McBurney.
I could be.
Yeah, wear a suit, Fax.
Play the game.
Yeah.
Is that right? Surely...
Wear a stout pair of brogues.
I know they've tried to get Tierney and Robertson into the same team. Uh-huh. I think they've done it in a 3-5-2, haven't they? One on the left of a three and one... Why don't you just play a 4-4-2 and put Tierney left back and tell Robertson, just go forward, right? That is a side that you would look at as any team and go, I don't really want to defend against that.
Yes and no, because even if I think Robertson is more of a tear away kind of fullback, perhaps a little bit speedier than Tierney, doesn't have the same crossing ability, I think, as Tierney,
okay,
which is absolutely extraordinary, honestly. So I don't know. If you put two players of this kind, who are sort of roving, adventurous fullbacks, you'll end up having a little bit of a clog up on the motorway, won't you? I mean, you need space. These are two players who need space. Robertson, I think, needs more space than Tierney, and naturally is more, I mean, goes forward more, perhaps, mm-hmm, and more in a quicker, faster, more determined way than Tierney. I don't know. That's a tough one. And to be honest, nobody has resolved the question yet.
No.
So there must be a reason for that. I mean, could you say inverted fullbacks? Why not?
Where are they?
You know, Ireland have the same problem with Matt Doherty.
Tony Cascarino and Ray Houghton.
No, with Matt Doherty and Seamus Coleman.
Yes.
You know, it's the exact same problem. And Matt Doherty, just this week, has been not complaining, but he was asked and spoke quite frankly about the fact that he only has 7 caps for Ireland. And
that's crazy, actually, when you think of it.
It is, but... I think it was Martin O'Neill, or was it Mick McCarthy in one of his early games? I think it was Martin O'Neill tried to play them together. It just didn't work. Mm. So Matt Doherty might play on the left this time because Enda Stevens is in or suspended or injured. He's not available anyway. So, but yeah, he spoke quite frankly about his frustration at not getting into the team. But Seamus Coleman is very good, and. But it is an identical problem, and it's unfortunate because teams like Scotland and Ireland aren't overburdened with world-class players. So when you've got two world-class players who both play in the same position, then it's annoying.
Oh, yeah, that's a way to Georgia. Georgia have taken 4 points from 5 games. It's a fight with Denmark and Switzerland, the Republic atop of Group D. Do you think they will qualify?
I do, actually, yeah. I have faith in McCarthy. I think Denmark are so sick of playing Ireland. They're basically, the white flag goes up now at this stage when they see us turning up. We've ground them into just submission just by the tedium of it all. So, yeah, I'm pretty optimistic. And again, like Scotland, we find goals hard to come by. We'll... this new young fella from Aaron Connolly, who did so well for Brighton at the weekend, he's been promoted from the under-21s, may well start. He looks like a prospect, but it's very early days.
Mm. You and Murray did a good piece about Stephen Kenny, the man in waiting, who's going to take Mick's job regardless of how well Mick does. Getting results for the under-21s and talking about playing nice, expansive, open football. And I personally don't want Ireland to ever play that sort of football, but it's interesting to hear him say that.
Yeah, sure is. I look forward to it when he takes over and see how long it takes him to see the error of his ways.
Do you think Mick will be sitting in the stand, Fergie-like, every time they'll just cut to Mick McCarthy, just shaking his head when Ireland try and play it out from the back?
I think you might be doing Mick an injustice here. My memory isn't very good, but I think some of the most expansive football Ireland have played was under his first reign.
Was that knock it long to Narkin and Robbie Keane? Hey, Philippe, what about an update from France?
It's a team of walking wounded. I mean, loads of players. I mean, think the news are dominated by what's happening to the players who are not there. So, i.e., of course, the captain Hugo Lloris, who is out until 2020. Paul Pogba, who is not getting any better and so is not going to play. And Kylian Mbappe, and it's starting to become a little bit worrying because he's had these problems for quite a while now. And he's basically retired from the squad as well. So that's three very big players missing from two games, which are not, I mean, if France were to win those two games, they would almost certainly qualify. And the games are against Iceland, in Iceland, and against Turkey. So they're not that easy as fixtures. And the other thing as well is, I mean, there are questions linked to these absentees, like who's going to play in goal, and which is a bit of a problem because there are people saying it should be Areola and so forth, Maignan, whatever. And also Olivier Giroud.
Because he shouldn't play in goal. I mean, I don't think so.
Giroud is really one of the mainstays of Deschamps' system. He's one of the players he trusts the most. But they had a meeting, I think, on Monday, Deschamps and Giroud, in which Deschamps basically said, if you don't play at all for Chelsea, there's no way I can carry on selecting you. Deschamps never changes his mind, and so it would be a huge thing for him to decide to drop Giroud. But there is a real chance it might happen, but probably not during this international break. But if or should Giroud not get playing time after that, I think we're looking at quite almost like a revolution in the way France are playing, because he's one of the fulcrums of the team.
Marcus, what are Sweden doing? What's your Swedish update?
Sweden are playing Malta and should win, and playing Spain and should lose. So it's kind of, we go,
ladies
on,
and gentlemen, Marcus Christensen.
We go on to November and then we play Romania away.
Which will leave them where? If they do that,
if we beat Romania, we should finish second behind Spain, and that's all we can hope for, really.
Right, let's talk about England's women. They won 1-0 in Portugal. Not the main story. The main story was Phil Neville getting pretty angry after it all. Let's talk to the Guardian's women's football correspondent, Susie Rack. Susie, how are you doing?
I'm good, thanks. How are you?
I'm very well. I'm better than Phil Neville. He seemed a little bit prickly after that turgid 1-0 victory.
Yeah, I mean, he's clearly been stewing on the reports of the previous match, the 2-0 loss to Brazil. Personally, I actually didn't think they were too bad in that game overall. I mean, obviously, losing 2-0 was pretty poor, but there were decent moments, and there were like reassuring signs, particularly defensively, in the first half at least. But the reports kind of, you know, were not unfair, but just, you know, kind of talking about the football not being particularly great, lacking clarity, being outmaneuvered, they're missing ruthlessness, being poor, that kind of stuff, all across the board. One report described the football as tepid. Now, he has been stewing on this clearly all week, because he raised it in the pre-match press conference the day before the Portugal game, where he said, "Oh, I thought this was, shocking. The football was not tepid," and you know, really went for it, which, you know, for me was surprising given the kind of the, you know, a lot of the other things that were said about that game. Just saying it's lukewarm is not necessarily the worst that come out.
He said the performances over the last two games have been outstanding. I didn't see the Brazil game, Susie, but I saw the game against Portugal. I think outstanding is not the adjective I would have used.
No, I mean, the game against Portugal was pretty dire. There were like legitimate excuses for it, I suppose. You know, he had very few players available, particularly in the middle. But I mean, we're talking about a country with one of the biggest, if not the biggest, investments in the world in its international team, and a fully professional league. They should be able to handle even quite a significant number of injuries against a team ranked, I think it's 26 places below them in the FIFA rankings. So it was bad, and they were lucky to score, and they needed a bit of luck. But to describe it as outstanding, I mean, it was just surreal. And the thing is when you've written a match report with a narrative that, you know, is looking honestly at the game and reflecting on it and calling it what it is, which, you know, is not great, but at least they got the win. to then have the manager come out and say they were outstanding, the players were brilliant, I was proud of their performance, and you know, kind of praising them to the hilt. It's hard to put that in your match report because it completely goes against the narrative of what you've written, and just looks a little bit delusional. And I don't think he's a bad guy. I just think he doesn't really think through what he's actually saying very often. And it's getting to a point where, you know, the attack on the young journalist afterwards, where he said that she had, you know, called for him to be sacked when she hadn't. She had literally just pointed out that the last time a manager went 5 games without a win, Hope Powell was sacked, and every single journalist had said the same. He just looked like he's not coping with the pressure at all.
What do you think will happen?
It's hard to say. You know, because I've been one of the fairest on him generally. I wrote a piece back in September after the first friendlies after the World Cup, where they kind of lost against Norway and drew against Belgium, saying that, you know, those friendlies highlight defensive issues, but that he deserves time. And he's pushing people like me who were very much, you know, kind of, you know, he's not a bad guy. He's not done an amazing job, but he's not done a bad job either. You know, give him a chance. He's pushing us off that fence because he just sounds so kind of like defensive and is, you know, kind of falsifying the narrative of what's going on, and not just being honest and just saying, yeah, we were bad today, but we won, and that was what was important. We needed that win. We needed a bit of momentum results-wise going into the Wembley game against Germany. You know, just say that, and there's no story there. You know, that's pretty, you know, innocuous. Saying that you think we're outstanding, suddenly it becomes a big story because it's clearly mad.
The women players seem to be far more chatty and forthcoming than their male counterparts when talking to the media. What impression do you get from them on their thoughts about their manager? Because I can't help but think a goodly portion of them must think he's a complete idiot.
It's hard to tell. They are generally a lot more open, but they don't really, none of them have really kind of hinted behind the scenes that there, you know, there's frustrations there. There have been reports that Phil is frustrated with some of the players and them not kind of really pulling their weight and a layer feeling comfortable. But for me, that's his fault, because as a manager, you pick the players. You pick the players that start. If they're feeling comfortable, it's because you're picking them when they're not playing well enough. So there's that issue. Then I think there's definitely frustrations about players from players who, you know, have had really, really good seasons, particularly last season, and then not got the game time. You know, and it's just kind of subtle indications of that when you're speaking to the likes of Leah Williamson, who said, oh, maybe I should have been more vocal about wanting to have got on the pitch more during the World Cup. She got 10 minutes. She was the best defender in the league last season, and, you know, helped Arsenal to a title for the first time in 7 years. Then you've got Beth England, who, you know, kind of led the line for Chelsea when they were really not doing great and was their top scorer last season, and she can't get into the team ahead of players who are still sort of struggling with niggly injuries going into the World Cup. So I think there's like underlying frustrations that you get when, you know, when they're talking about the fact that they're struggling to get selected. But no one has really said, you know, oh, we've had enough of him. He's, you know, he's not up to it yet.
Yeah, I mean, tricky to say that when he is the current manager.
Well, I don't expect him to come out and say it, but, you know, the journalists and the footballers and the women's scene seem to get on a lot better and have a much better relationship than in the male game. So I thought you would get the vibe. And when I say idiot, Phil Neville's probably a grand bloke, but I really don't think he's up to this job personally.
Maybe we could get if there was some sort of detective in the world of football who could... Anyway, Susie, thanks so much for coming on.
No problem, cheers.
Susie right there, the Guardian women's football correspondent. Perhaps he's just a craven optimist. I sort of love that.
Well, maybe. You know,
I come off every pod going, that was the best thing anyone has ever done. How was it? It was absolutely brilliant. And maybe he feels the same.
I just think if you can't cope with a game being called tepid, you're not... International management is probably not for you. Is that fair?
In Phil Neville family news, Phil's son Harvey's been named in the Republic of Ireland under 19 squad for the first time for a friendly doubleheader against Denmark. Obviously Denmark. Neville, who moved to Old Trafford from Valencia in 2018, qualifies for the Republic through his mother Julie's family. Sunderland have sacked Jack Ross, Barry. I mean, I presume you knew that.
Yeah.
It's a news bulletin for you. They suffered their second defeat of the season at Lincoln on Saturday. 10th loss suffered by Ross in 75 games in charge. 6th in the table, 8 points behind the leaders Ipswich. The third tier's largest budget. Odds, Paul Cook's the favourite. Some other names, Gareth Ainsworth, Kevin Phillips, Roy Keane. Both you and Jonathan Wilson are 500-1.
I saw that. Yeah, you drew my attention to it. I haven't invested because that would probably be unethical, but I don't have any insider knowledge, so I would urge our listeners not to pile on to me or Wilson at 500.
I'd like to see you. I'd like to see you lose your hair when someone says you were tepid. but by all accounts, Sunderland fans seem to be not disappointed that he's gone.
I wasn't sure what I made of it, so I sort of went on Twitter to gauge the mood, and while it's not the probably a very accurate barometer of public opinion, it seemed to be thinly disguised jubilation that Jack Ross was gone. He wasn't doing terribly, he wasn't doing particularly well. I'd quite like to see Gareth Ainsworth get the gig, to be honest. I rate him, he seems like a good bloke. He's done a good job at Wickham under, you know, very straitened circumstances, and I think he's earned the opportunity to do a job with a bigger club. Although, you know, you go to Sunderland, I think this is their 10th full-time manager they're looking for in as many years, or 11th in 10. It's a bit of a gamble.
You mentioned Wickham. It was in The Athletic the other day. A group made up of Dennis Bergkamp, Henrik Larsson, Dirk Kuyt, another high-profile Dutch international, plus Ronald Koeman as an advisor, had made a bid for Wickham Wanderers with a view to catapulting Wickham into stardom.
I thought you said with a view of catapulting them in the Eredivisie.
Why not? Or just playing them all. That would be fun, isn't it? Larsson, Kuyt and Bergkamp.
Oof.
Koeman. Oof. Just pulling the strings.
Pretty decent team there.
Pretty decent.
Now, bizarrely, Baz, you're also quoted at 501 for the Reading job. I mean, it's closer to home, isn't it? After they sacked Jose Gomez, Mark Bowen is odds on, and Mark Hughes is 7-4. They normally come together. So maybe Mark Hughes has said, listen, I've always been number one. Why don't you be number one for a bit to Mark Bowen? Gomez joined at the end of December 2018, steered the club away from the threat of relegation. This is on the Reading website. Following just 2 wins in the first 11 games of this season, the owner has made the difficult decision to part company with Gomez and make a change at first team level. They even had a Portugal day to celebrate when they kept Reading up. Baz, you are nowhere near the odds for the Barnsley job.
Okay.
They sacked
disappointing
manager Daniel Stendel with the club 23rd in the Championship. He got them promoted last year from League One. Adam Murray, the club's under-18 head coach, steps in as caretaker. It was a nice picture of Stendel having a few beers with some fans. I think the fans like him a great deal and weren't happy that he's gone.
Yeah.
Jan Seawoot, Gary Rowett mentioned. Rowett is the favourite for the Millwall job, by the way. Speaking of Stendel, Fleetwood boss Joey Barton has denied assaulting him during an incident after a game against Barnsley on the 13th of April. He's alleged to have pushed him, leaving him with a damaged tooth. Barton appeared at Barnsley Magistrates Court on Wednesday, pleaded not guilty to assault occasioning actual bodily harm, was given unconditional bail, will appear at Sheffield Crown Court on the 6th of November. And that'll do for part two. We'll start part three with Marcus's Baby, the Next Gen series. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Marcus, the Next Gen series. 2014, you decided it would be interesting to pick the best young players from each Premier League club, as well as 40 from around the world, follow their progress. That seems like quite a large undertaking. Do you regret it?
Absolutely, 100%. It seemed like such a good idea, and you think, how bad can it be? And then suddenly you expand it to 60 from around the world, and then you get updates from all of them, and suddenly there's 360 players or whatever to look after, and people to file a copy for and to put in spreadsheets and interactives. And a month into this process, which normally takes about 3 months, I think, why did I do this? But then, like this week when it's published and you can go through them and see how they've done and so on, I think, okay, that's why I did it. It's worth it.
And so this is this year is the last year we'll hear about, well, with this series, we may hear about them while they're playing, the first set that you picked. And it's quite interesting to see sort of how many you've made it and where they've got to.
That was the reason we did it. And we've looked at the stats and so on. And from the 20 Premier League ones, so we picked the best player we thought then from the when the first year scholars, and out of those, 23 are playing in the Premier League, Rashford, Solanke and Chaudhry at Leicester, and 6 are playing in the second tier in the Championship, and one of them in Iceland, 2 in the fourth tier, 1 in the sixth tier, 1 in the seventh, 1 in the eighth, 2 are not playing football at all as far as we're concerned, and 2 are still at under 23 level. So it's a huge spread, and this perhaps no surprise, but just to think that we picked 20 of the very best of an academy at those Premier League clubs and 3 have made it, it just shows even if you get to that stage when you're so good at the age of 17, there's still a very small chance that you make it as a Premier League player.
The two who aren't playing football at all, I mean, do we know what they're doing or where they are?
No, we've tried to track them down. I can't remember. I think it's the Burnley and the Hull play from 2014, and obviously injuries play part. And I think it's fascinating to know as well that some of the players who were best then have not made it. I think in 2015 we had this Hashim Mastour. Do you remember this? The Moroccan kid who played or was at Milan's books. He had a million kind of followers on Facebook and Twitter and so on, and he never played once for Milan, and he doesn't have a club now. And then you have people like João Félix at Atletico now. He wasn't considered among the best in Portugal 2 or 3 years ago, so we didn't pick him and so on. And then you step up. So even in that, between 17, 18, 19, you can make so much improvement and become a world player. And some of them just, but I think mentally, I think it's so important to be strong mentally to make it. And I think they can be the most talented kids in the world. And there was one kid at Chelsea who they were, I think he was Bulgarian, and there were pictures of him doing kippy-uppies, and he had the most amazing skills you've ever seen, kind of thing. But they knew that he wouldn't go and make it because mentally he wasn't strong enough.
I think the interesting thing is as well, because although it's younger than when you pick these players, the idea that football clubs pick players at 8, 7, 8, and 9, you know, move them away from their parents at 13 and 14. The fact that it's obviously very difficult to know because you can only take one path, but actually you could be not the best at 16, 17 or 18 and still make it, and you could be touted as the best at 8 and get absolutely nowhere.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the madness of picking someone at 8 or 9. It's bonkers. I guess they're trying to protect themselves of not missing out of that gem, but that's 1 in 10,000 or something. So the whole industry in that. But got so many examples, like Ben Woodburn, obviously one of the Liverpool picks from a few years ago, has not had the career path we thought. But then Alexander Arnold was, and so on. And I don't think you know. Unless you speak to the club, get a picture of how strong they are mentally, what their kind of application is and so on. You can't tell by just how good they are as footballers at 16, 17, whether they're going to make it or not.
And in that first set of the foreign players, you had Tielemans, Ousmane Dembele, Ruben Neves as well.
Yeah, yeah. And they are the group of players where you know they're so good. They're making their first team debut. So we're launching the 2019 this week. So the world one today has Ansu Fati at Barcelona, who's already made his debut for Barcelona, scored for them and so on. So you know he's already made it. But there could be others that come. And Tielemans, I think, is a good example. He made his debut. He played 200 games by the age of 19 or something. So they are so good that they are not going to fail.
Tielemans, I actually know quite well his first man coach, who is still in charge of the young guys at Anderlecht. Mm. And he said exactly that. He was so far ahead of absolutely everybody. They never had any doubt. But why was he so far ahead? This is what my friend Mo says. He said, in his head, he was ahead of everybody else. He had exactly the right attitude from the very, very young age. He had a very healthy family and entourage, which is, of course, a big problem. Because when we're talking about club signing players 8 or 9, we have to know, of course, that it is many of the practices which are not actually strictly illegal. There's no other word. We shouldn't beat about the bush about that. But that, yes, there is a very small number of players, like Kylian Mbappe, for example, was already singled out when he was 11 years old as being the next great thing. And clubs knew they didn't have a chance of getting him. So, but I'm absolutely astonished, I must say, by the fail rate, because you're talking about 17-year-old players when there's already been a huge selection before that.
Yes. I've been in academies maybe for 5 or 6 years.
That's incredible.
Take the Spurs player, Marcus Edwards, from a few years back. He was outstanding, but he can't remember where he is now. Actually, I think he's gone on loan again. Or Marcus Maguana from Arsenal, who went to Barcelona.
Charlie Musonda at Chelsea, who was supposed to be the greatest prospect they had for a very long time.
Yeah, but I don't think that if you're playing in the second tier in the Championship, it's not fair. They are outstanding footballers. I don't think it's fair, and even in fourth, fifth tier, so they're very, very good footballers. I don't think you can judge success or failure just by that, and so many have ACL injuries and so on. It's quite frightening to see he's been out for a year, and then we had Abdelhak Nouri, who obviously collapsed on the pitch. He was one of the, and one Swedish guy, Kevin Ackerman, last year he signed for Fiorentina as a 17-year-old, and then they saw a heart defect on his when he had his medical and so on. He's now had an operation and is back after a year, but you do, like, they are like any other normal people, things outside the pitch will happen to them, and so on. There's a selection of 80 young people, and everything can happen, so it's not a straight line, and it's not always whether they're good or not good enough whether they're going to make it.
Yeah, well, I mean, when you hit the age of 16, 17, you get a whole new set of challenges and temptations. You know, a young man's mind can wander.
How do you know?
Drink, drugs, ladies, men, whatever. But it's no surprise that guys fall by the wayside, because it's very easy to get fond of the good life. And
but the other thing as well is there is no, and it's very striking what you say, that only one of them was playing abroad, because the pathway is not there for young English players.
No.
And I think that you would see that the fail rate in, for example, French top clubs or Belgian top clubs would not be the same, because they do tend to also look at abroad as a possibility.
Mm. Well, look, go and look at it on the Guardian website. All very interesting. Thanks for doing all that work for 5 years, Marcus. Have another contract. More than 3,500 tickets been sold to female fans for Iran's World Cup qualifier against Cambodia in Tehran today. On the face of it, Philippe, that sounds like a good news story. Am I wrong?
It is a tiny step forward. We've got to remind ourselves that none of this would have happened if Sahar Khodayari hadn't died, set fire for herself, to herself, because she was not allowed to get into the stadium to watch a men's game, and of the international outcry which has followed. But there's been a campaign. The campaign has been going on for years, including incredibly bravely by the captain of the Iran national team, Masoud Shojaei. I think you had his sister.
We did, yeah.
Mariam, yeah. And it has to be said, it sticks a bit in the craw to hear FIFA patting themselves on the back as they did yesterday because of this very, this fixture. The stadium, I think, holds 75,000. I think 7,000 tickets have been sold. The special women's enclosure, because it's a women's enclosure, they're penned in. You would have thought, well, perhaps you could open it to more than 3,000, but no, that's not out of the thing. And you can't, the cynic in you cannot help but think that there is an element of pure propaganda about that, and the fear of finally getting a ban from FIFA. So it's a tiny step. Mm-hmm. At least people are talking about it.
Yeah.
And we will, that is a good thing.
We'll carry on talking about it. Also in that group, Iraq versus Hong Kong.
Yeah, it's absolutely, yeah. In Basra.
In Basra, right.
In Basra, yes. Now that's a game that of some importance, given the events in Iraq, where I think over 100 people have been killed in demonstrations in the recent past. So it's a game which is very highly charged, and also obviously the Hong Kong fans, and they will be Hong Kong fans. For them, football has become a means to express their disgust at what is happening to their country. And for example, they boo the Chinese national anthem. You probably have seen there are a few films on Twitter and various social networks about what happened at their last international game. It was very impressive. So football has really become a means for them to have their voices heard when they're being crushed, hit over the head and shot at by policemen. So, yeah, quite a game.
In football close to home, apparently ITV are in for the Champions League. That's a bid to bring it back to terrestrial TV. This is Martin Ziegler in The Times. When UEFA holds its auction of broadcast rights, they sent the tender for 2021 to 24 to broadcasters in the UK this week. Understood that Sky are also keen to try and nick it back off BT Sport. Henrik says, will speaking in Qatar have a long-term impact on Pochettino's reputation? He attended the Aspire Global Summit on football performance. Him and his assistant, Jesus Perez, delivered a seminar on Monday which focused on the importance of keeping control of players' emotions. Poch said, whenever we come here to Qatar and Aspire, we're encouraged and struck by the vision, planning and passion for this country shows for sports development. Several other Premier League clubs, including Arsenal, Liverpool, Manchester United, have representatives there. Key figures from Barcelona, Real Madrid, Juve, number of other European giants, alongside figures from the FA and the Welsh FA as well. Mm-hmm. Managers invited to previous events as guest speakers have included Thomas Tuchel, Crystal Palace boss Roy Hodgson, apparently Eto, Crespo, Tim Cahill among the highlight speakers this week.
I think it's what you say as much as what you do, and there was no obligation for him to go beyond the line, and he crossed the line there. I think this is what people feel so disappointed about. The fact that people use Doha, and I should say as well, the United Arab Emirates, let's not forget about them, as regular basis for football events, training camps. Aspire is genuinely a hub of football expertise in the region. Actually, you could say, all right, okay, it happens. But what he did is that he went just that little bit too far, especially speaking after the World Athletics, you know, championships, where everybody, the images everybody will remember is empty stadiums and marathon runners struggling to make it over the line. Again, I think his image has taken a really big knock because of that.
Perhaps more fun, Marcus. Zlatan, a statue has been unveiled in Malmo, 8'9" and 500 kilos. I was
smaller than kilos. The original.
I was slightly disappointed that his speech was quite humble, and he sort of said, you know, if I can do this, anyone can, you know. I was expecting him to go, you know, Zlatan is the lion of every, or, you know, typical Zlatan.
Yeah, I think there was a long interview with him, actually, a very good interview in the Swedish paper Expressen, where he talked about many different things, about growing up in Sweden with a different name and looking slightly different to all Swedes and so on. And I think I wouldn't describe him as mature, perhaps, just yet, but I think he's maybe heading in that direction, obviously, being a father and so on. And he's still Zlatan. He always will be. I think as a Swede, we should be thankful for having had him and played so long, and it certainly deserves a statue, and it was far better than most others I've seen, actually.
Yeah, it looks quite like him. Yeah.
Exactly, and he was pleased with it and so on, so it's the right thing to do, and he came across quite well, actually, in this interview.
There's a great clip from the Northern Ireland Football League. Glentoran forward Darren Murphy is on a booking and is substituted, and he's nearer one side of the pitch than the other, but he wants to take up the time and so jogs towards the dugout, and the referee blows his whistle and starts chasing him. And just as Darren Murray gets to the byline to go off, the referee gives him a second yellow card and sends him off. Because you have to leave the nearest side to the pitch. Absolutely hilarious. And by the letter of the law, the right thing to do. I'm slightly Mike Deeney behaviour.
I'd be slightly miffed if I was waiting to come on.
And obviously,
what are you doing? Come on. And then you can't come on.
Guildford news. After last week, we were asking what Luis Figo is doing in Guildford being chased by a spaceman.
Do we know?
Well, yes, many people got in touch. David Wright, amongst others, says the University of Surrey were doing a physics space fair in the High Street. And that didn't necessarily explain why Luis Figo was there. Apparently, and I forget who told me this, apparently his daughter is studying there, so that could all be why. But since then, Petr Cech has signed for the ice hockey club, the Guildford Phoenix, until the end of the season. I'm delighted to have the opportunity to play with the Phoenix to get the match experience. I hope that this young team can achieve their goals for the season, try to win as many games as possible. Jake says, with Petr Cech now playing ice hockey, which footballers would you like to be in your ice hockey team?
The two Longstaff brothers, because apparently their father was a Great Britain international with over 100 games, and he also played for the Swedish club Djurgården.
Excellent news.
For one season.
Your predecessor, Max, was quite the keen ice hockey player, as was, or is his boy.
Was he?
Mm.
Really?
Mr. and Master Richardson. Although my Canadian brother-in-law would get very upset if he heard us calling it ice hockey, because it's just hockey, Barry.
Oh, I see. Now, in the Elite League, Guildford Flames are ninth, but that isn't Guildford Phoenix. I thought I'd found the right division. For those of you who want to know, Glasgow Clan are currently winning the ice hockey Elite League. Sean Harvey News, the outgoing head of the EFL, in an interview with The Telegraph, he said, genuinely, we opened up discussions with the International Space Station about doing the Carabao Cup draw. Sam says, how many rejected proposals were there between the International Space Station and Colin Dale Morris?
Bravo.
In DJ news, Guy Scamendieta is the guest DJ on the Saturday, the 19th of October at the Shacklewell Arms. Expect to hear the likes of the Velvet Underground, Bell and Sebastian, Pulp, the Breeders, Comic Gain, the National, and more. Quite sounds like a nice
field.
Yeah.
Alt pop.
Where is the Shacklewell Arms? We'll go to that.
It's in Dalston.
Tempted to go along, Max, if you fancy a night out for our Sunday show.
Jeff's having a 40th birthday party, I'm afraid.
Who?
Just my friend Jeff.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah. Otherwise, I'd definitely be there. Mendieta, I once was responsible for somebody putting a Viennetta in his hand on Soccer AM and him looking very confused. But there weren't, and there was nothing else that rhymed with Mendieta for the feature we needed. William says, is there anything that Marcus and Philippe do that is so quintessentially Swedish and French that they get annoyed that they do it?
I've thought about this, and the answer, no, I wasn't able to find. I'm terribly sorry to disappoint you.
Do you ever baste yourself in herrings, Marcus?
No,
knock
sadly
up a quick
not.
Wardrobe.
I mean, most people in the office would probably say that I should run around naked in East Finchley, but I don't, thankfully.
Okay. Marcus once walked 12 miles to have 2 pints with me.
Wow. I would do it again.
Is that very Swedish?
Oh, well, it was weird.
Because everyone's so far apart in Sweden, you know, that's what you have to do. You put your tennis rackets on your feet and clamber through the snow.
He was the nearest guy, and I just said, you fancy a pint? Okay, I'll be on my way.
I thought, well, if you walk 12 miles, at least get on it for the rest of the day. But no, 2 pints, and then I have to go and pick my kids up from school.
Did you walk home again?
Also, I don't normally have 2 pints before I pick my kids up. I think we should clarify that.
2 is probably okay, isn't it?
2 is okay.
Why do you not get the bus?
I fancied a walk.
12 miles?
It was hot as well.
Fair enough. All right, that'll do. Philippe, thank you.
Thank you.
Marcus, thank you.
Thank you.
Barry, thank you.
You're welcome.
Back on Monday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.